see. So, the TechNet is run by the Bergen Amateur Radio Association weekly for the purposes of exchanging information about amateur radio, electronics, communications, computers, and things in our society that depend on those things. Anybody who wishes to bring up a topic is more than welcome to, and if you don't have a topic, we encourage you to check in anyway, because your presence will tell us much about what we need to do as far as how we address a subject that might come up. So in order to make this a sensible exercise, we check in with our call sign, our name, and then we indicate whether we have a question, a comment, both, or none of the above. So, with no further ado, and God knows we've had a little delay getting started here tonight, let us begin. Any station whose call sign begins with the letter alpha, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question, a comment, both, or none of the above. Please call K2BAR. Okay, nothing heard. So I guess our next call sign group will be, probably the Novembers. Any November stations, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question, comment, or both, or none of the above. Please call K2BAR.
This is NS2K, Jim. No traffic at this point.
Okay, Jim, good evening to you. Yeah, I don't seem to have any functional power going into my computer, and I think I figured out why. Alrighty. That's much better. Alrighty. Any other November stations, please call K2BAR. Alrighty. How about those ever popular... Both or none of the above.
Try that again, Gordon. You lost it.
I lost it. I'm not in the repeater.
Can we have the ever popular...
I wonder why. I'm okay now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, let's try the ever popular whiskey stations. Please call K2BAR.
72JEK, Don, no questions.
Don, good evening to you. I know you have an announcement, however. And any other whiskey stations?
WE2R, Charlie, no questions.
Good evening, Charlie. Good hearing you. I heard you on 6 meters last night. I didn't have a chance to jump in. I was taking care of other things, but it was nice to hear you anyway. Alrighty. Any other whiskeys? Okay. Alright. We're going to try to do this in as sensible a way as possible. Kilo twos. If you have the letter kilo followed by the number two directly, it's your turn. Please call K2BAR.
K2BAR. This is K2ZO. And I do have a question.
Awesome, Jim. How are you this evening? Very good. We'll get your question posed to you promptly. Any other kilo twos?
K2ZCK, no questions.
Good evening, Jim. Dave. By the way, I heard you up on Echolink, so I have a question about that for you as to what that was about. Just be aware that we're going to be looking for that after Jim's question. So, very good to you. Any other kilo twos?
K2DSL, David, no questions or comments at this moment.
Good evening, David. K2DSL, very good. And pleasant good evening to you as well. Any other kilo twos?
Kilo two, Alpha Mike India, K2ALI, Tony. No questions, but I have a comment about the recent repair.
The recent repair of?
supply.
Okay. We'll hear more about that. So I have you down as a comment. Very good. Any other Kilo 2s? Okie dokie, let's do it. All the Kilo, everybody else's.
2BAR, this is KC2PYB. Richard, no questions or comments.
Hi, Richard. I was wondering where you were. I was going to call you tonight after the net if you didn't come in. Alrighty, any other Kilos?
KC2FQP, Stuart. I have questions.
Good evening, Stuart. Yes, we'll take your questions. No problem. Alrighty, any other Kilos?
Hey, Ben. I have a question.
Hey, I hear Ben with a question. Who is the station to double with Ben? There's another station in there with Ben. Please call K2BAR. 480. Very good. And let's see. Any other Kilos? Alrighty. Any other stations who have not checked in at this time, please call K2BAR.
K2BAR, this is N2OEL.
Okay. Never mind. Hi, Noel. Boy, you sound perky. You sound like you're, they got you on some sort of speed there, buddy. Well, good to hear you. Alright. Noel, question or comment for the net?
No questions or comments.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, we're going to probably get some input from you anyway at some point. Any other stations?
N2NNU, just listening.
N2NNU. Good to hear you, Alex. Long time no hear. We'll log you in. Very good. Any other stations?
November to X-ray, Juliet in November, mobile, just listening.
Okay, November to X-ray, Juliet, November, your name, sir?
My name is Wesley, W-E-S-L-E-Y, and I'm mobile next to my house, waiting for the parking spot, and this is Muspet, part of Queens. Back to you.
Very good, Wesley. Good to hear you. Excellent. Glad you joined us tonight. Any other stations? So I've got three questions, a question for one of the members of K2ZC, and a comment from K2AMI, and probably another comment from W2JEK as well. So let's see. Let's start off with K2ZO's question. K2VAR, got you?
Okay, K2BAR. This is K2ZO. And say hello to Alex there, N2NNU, who checked into the 10-meter net the other night. Question I got, if you remember, we were talking about running radios in the car that wasn't set up for, you know, no connection directly to the battery and stuff like that. And I mentioned to you that I had seen a system using an ICOM box sold by ICOM, which contained a large 4 microfarad capacitor, which would allow you to run a 100-watt single sideband radio off a limited outlet, like a 10-amp outlet cigar lighter, so that you know you wouldn't have to modify the car or hook to the battery and all that stuff. Got about a little bit more, and then I ran into some people running some big audio amplifiers, 400 and 500 watts. Believe it or not, out of their car. And they have large banks of capacitors that charge up, that take care of the peak draw, so that the battery doesn't see that big thing, that big hit, but yet they work. My question is, I realize that with 4 or 5 microfarad, 4 or 5 fat, you could really kill yourself. Not kill yourself, but you could probably blow things out. How do they do it? I mean, You don't just take something like that and put it right across the 12 volts, do you? I'd love to find a circuit like that. Of course, I asked this audio guy who knew nothing. But it was quite interesting to see the bank of capacitors in his car running a 500-watt audio amplifier. How about that? Anybody got any ideas? I'd look for a circuit. You know, I've not seen this in reference to amateur use, but apparently these audio guys have been doing it for years. Back to that. It's K2ZO.
Enjoy.
And Julio, go ahead.
Well, Jim, if you remember, I brought a 2-farad capacitor in because I had a switching power supply that was rated at 20 amps. But with a 2-farad capacitor, you could run a single sideband rig and never worry about the peak. And if you remember, I bought the kit knife and hooked it directly across the output, and it had absolutely no problem. We just switched it on, switched it off, and watched the voltage, because it had the meter built in. It was one of those made for the car audio nuts. And when we switched it off, we just slowly watched the voltage drop as it drops down through leakage. But I don't think that they put any limiting circuit or anything. I think it comes straight with 4-gauge cables from the battery to the capacitor cap. I've never seen anything other than that. Back to net. This is Ventuolio.
W2JEK.
Hey, Doc.
Okay, I remember you had a very perplexing, really trouble in what we call 43-8 carrier. Put in a teletype system up on the fifth floor. So he moved it up from third floor, and then we went to put another one in, and we weren't getting the right readings. And to find out that on channel 4, where on the previous the carrier group was Dow Jones, we looked at a new group, there's Dow Jones. What's going on? And we finally tracked the thing down by using dry cell batteries. I mean, they're talking in the 130-volt battery feed range. And what they have, and if they have a lead coming in from the power room with 130 volts on it. And on the power panel is a large inductor. After the power goes through that, and then it goes out to the load and on the fuse panel. Now, one of the things that they do on the fuse panel is they have two fuses. One is a fuse through a resistor to the capacitor, which is grounded, and what they use, they call that the charging fuse. They very slowly build up the charge with a resistor in series, and once that is capacitor is charged, then you put the regular fuse in, which does not have a resistor in it. So that's how you get this thing charged without popping the big fuse down in the cellar in the power room. Fuses were missing, our troubles disappeared. Back to net, W2JEK.
Perhaps I can help to answer any.
So they're using an inductor to basically limit the current. That's basically what you're saying?
No. The inductor is part of it's like an L network circuit. And all the garbage that's generated by the teletype units filters off the ground and is kept up in up near the equipment. It doesn't go spreading all throughout the building. That's why the inductor was there. But to bleed off that stuff, use the capacitor to ground. This was on the load side of the inductor, not the power room side of the inductor, if you understand what I'm driving at. And when this capacitor had to be charged up and connected in, now, you couldn't just put the capacitor in. They had two fuses, one that had a resistor in series to the capacitor, and another one that went directly to the
directly to the capacitor so that the you could charge it up through the series resistor. And then once it was charged, then you could put in the regular fuse. Back to that, that's 2JEK.
So I'm having trouble understanding this. So there are two leads. I mean, I'm looking at a capacitor. I get the fact that it's fed through a resistor, and I'm assuming a fuse. So the current limiting of the resistor keeps, you know, the fuse from popping and keeps the capacitor happy. Do you then take off from that same pin to the load side of the capacitor? Is that what's happening? In which case, that might make sense. So is it like a T-network, basically? So you've got resistive on the source side, and on the sink side, you have just a straight wire?
So basically, what you have is a capacitor that is to ground. And to get to that capacitor from the 130 volts, you will go through, firstly, a fuse that has a resistor in series to the capacitor. In other words, you don't just hook this capacitor up to your 130 volt power line. You hook it up with a fuse that has a resistor in series, a charging fuse, as they call it. Once the capacitor is charged, then you put the other fuse in. Then that way now you basically have a capacitor to ground that is without any, because you've got the regular fuse in there. Once it's been charged, you just have a capacitor you have the capacitor is hooked right into the circuit, but if you just don't hook it right in, you hook it beginning with the resistor in series. You just using this resistor, which is how they did it. So that you wouldn't charge it up, you didn't just slap on a capacitor, you slapped in a thing and it charged up, and I don't know just how long it used to take to charge, but you can understand that a high-value capacitor just gets 130 volts put on it like that. And also there's another fuse down in the basement, in the power room basement, where this 130 volts starts from, might decide to go pop, and then you really got yourself a problem because you killed all your 130 volts throughout the building. So that's why you have this kind of a thing. Back to net.
I got you. So basically what you're doing is the second fuse goes in parallel with the resistor at a later time. I was a little dense. I get it. All right, very good, Don. Anybody else have any comments about it? Station?
Not sure, did I get the floor or not, N2NNU?
Go ahead, Alex, no problem.
Okay. One has not to forget that the positive lead of the battery contains embedded in it a fusible link, which is actually based on some sort of wire that is supposed to burst out if there is a short circuit somewhere into the car. So this is why we need that inrush current limiter circuitry that the other gentleman was talking about, because on the high capacitance that we're talking about, hundreds of farads there, the inrush current could overpass the capacity of that link. So simple it is, a resistor in series with a capacitor, that then after several seconds of charging the capacitor is shorted by a relay. That's all that is to it. Back to net.
Sure, and that's very similar to the insertion of the second fuse in Don's case. Very good. Alrighty, anybody else?
F2ID.
Go ahead, Mr. Bennett.
So, saying pretty much what everybody else says, except you want to do this experimentally with the least amount of problems. You just figure the capacitor to be a dead short against the battery. If you know what the amperage of the fuse that protects that circuit, let's say it's a 10-amp fuse in there, so you make sure that the resistor that you put in series with the battery would limit the current to something less than 10 amps. So let's say you got 12-volt battery, so you put a 20-ohm resistor in series with the battery, and that would make sure you don't blow out the car fuse. And then you give it time to charge up, and the time constant of the resistor times the battery in farads, which is the time. Let's say that you got the 10 farad capacitor and a 20 ohm resistor, so that's 20 times 10, that's 200 seconds for the battery to get up to 70% of its value, and you wait a little bit longer, that'll be close enough to the full battery voltage, double that 20 seconds to 400 seconds, and then you'll be perfectly safe. You can short out the battery with a switch and as an experimental thing, and you'll be perfectly safe. If you short out, that is the resistance, of course, in series with the battery, and that series circuit is in parallel with the battery and your load. And then you simply, after the time has elapsed, that you simply calculate by multiplying the resistor that you put in series with the battery times the farad value of the battery. That's the time constant to get to 73% of its final value in seconds. But it slows down after that. It's the logarithmic curve, an exponential curve, rather. So you multiply that by 2, that gives you plenty of time. You're safe at that point. You short out the resistor, you're all set, and there you go. If you want to be really safe with the whole thing, you put a fuse in series with that, and so that if you accidentally have to switch in the wrong position, that fuse would blow and make that fuse somewhat less than the fuse you got in the car. But that would give you something that would be safe and would work in an experimental system. And then if you want something permanent, you've got to use some kind of relay or something. Maybe a relay operating all across the... Excuse me, I dropped out. A relay operating across the resistor when the voltage of the resistor is high, which means current is high, then you make sure that it's open, and when the current drops down, you can short the whole thing out. Something like that. Maybe it isn't too clever. Maybe it isn't too good. You get a little bit caught. But that ought to work. KF2ID with KTBAR.
Okay, very good. Anybody else? Yes, I have an idea. Go ahead, Noel. Ben, that was really instructive, too. I liked your safely implemented experiment. Go ahead, Noel. If you get the self-resetting automotive circuit breakers, if you dispense with everything, just put the thing in, get it by a 10-amp circuit breaker. If it draws more than, most of the cigarettes are fused at 15 amps, if it draws more than 10 amps, it will open. And meanwhile, it'll have charged it up somewhat, and in about 5 seconds, it'll close, and you'll be on your way. I put one of those on my electric tricycle, and I use it to keep myself from sucking down the batteries with 35 amps, 40 amps, which they'll do if I try to start it as a stall. So I put a 15 amp one on there, and it just, if I draw too much, it just opens and then closes itself in a few seconds. So perhaps that might be a simple solution. It may open once while it starts charging, but then when it closes, you should be there. And to all y'all.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Anybody have any comments on what Noel was suggesting?
K20.
Good, Mr. Jim.
Okay. Well, first of all, a comment about what Alex's comment was. He's 100% right.
If you short your battery these days, you're going to burn that link right out, and no more battery. So you just can't hang something like that across it. The interesting thing, when I looked at ICOM product, which I don't think is sold in the United States, as we know, our friend that has it is from Japan. This thing is a box that you put your ICOM 7000 or ICOM 706 in, and then hook it up to basically your cigar lighter or something, a 10-amp service. And when you turn it on, there's a light that says wait until this thing charges up. And then when it charges up, I did not hear a relay. Maybe it's solid state or maybe it's very quiet. But there's some circuit in this thing that changes where it says, okay, ready. And I assume that's what we're talking about here, where it monitors the thing until it gets up to the right voltage. And basically, I guess that's what I'm looking for. I'd like to find a schematic for something like this because I'd love to build it. Back to that, K2ZO.
Can you hurry up?
Who is that?
Got our idea. Just throw the resistor across the circuit breaker. Turn on the power. The circuit breaker will open. The resistor will charge it. When the circuit breaker, then you're ready to go. I'm a great one for simplicity and 2OEL.
I don't trust circuit breaker.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Jim on that one. For a low current, it might be okay. For a higher current, I think I would be in fear. Anyway. Alrighty. Anybody else?
WJK.
Go ahead, Don.
In my recollection, on this 130 volt circuit I was talking about, I think they used a 1.5 amp pair fuses on both of them, the little grasshopper kind of fuse, type of fuse. And you put the one in, and you know the charge, of course. There's a whole bell system practice on this, I'm sure, someplace. And then you put everything got up to snuff with the capacitor, and you put the second fuse in. That's how it operated. With the second fuse actually went directly to the capacitor rather than... So basically you had two fuses going from the 130 volts to the capacitor. Just the one and the third amp. And the basic thing is, once you got it charged, the only thing that the capacitor was doing is handling the hash that was generated by these teletype units that, or whatever it was, filtering. Didn't need a whole heavy fuse. As a very, it was fused. Remember, it's just the what's being used in that case was a filter circuit. Here in these cases that you have, Jim, you're using it as a battery circuit, so you definitely would want to have a bigger fuse to handle the load of the that you're dealing with during the peaks when the power is being drained out of the capacitor. Back to that W2JK.
Any other comments?
Yeah, it's quite unclear as to, you know, some of those old Bell system practices or BSPs, where those are. Some of them became AT&T PEs, some of them became Bell Corp methods and procedures, or advisories. Others became various operating system or operating company practices, but all good, though. A lot of that material is still out there and been, you know, put into electronic form, so it can be found on the internet, amazingly enough. It wouldn't be a bad way to start, Jim, actually, looking for a circuit to handle some of this stuff. I think this is going to be an ongoing saga. Anybody else have any questions or comments on this subject? Okie dokie. Well, before we go to K2 Zulu Charlie, I just want to make a quick announcement that tomorrow we're running a, what do you call it, a one-day amateur radio course for the technician class license. Don and his test team from Barrow will be in about 7 in the evening to administer exams. If you're taking an exam other than a technician, you need to let Don know, preferably now would be good, so that he can have that prepared for you. Just a reminder, long day, you need to bring $15 and form or two forms of ID and either your FRN if you have a amateur license or your social security number. You must bring your social security number if you are new. I think you need to bring it if you are renewing, but the FRN will be sufficient, I think. If not, we can certainly look it up. Well, we can't look it up, actually. I'm sure you know your social security number. In any case, the course will start at a little before, about 8:45, I guess. We gather 8:30 for some bagels and some goodies to get you people fired up, and then we feed you lunch and dinner. It'll be a delightful time. And Ron, WBGAI, will be helping tomorrow. He's going to be in residence helping out with that.
Simon?
Yes, sir.
This is W2JEK, just before anybody goes away. If you have a license, you must bring your original amateur license and a photocopy of that amateur license. If it may have an FRN number, it may not have an FRN number. One way or the other, we have to see your license. Just can't say, oh, my FRN number is thus and so. We have to see the license, the original license, plus I want a photocopy. Also, if there should be a person that has a CSCE, and we did have a fellow recently with one of these, if you're bringing a CSCE from another test that you just took, let's say, last week, and it hasn't been processed through the mill yet, and this particular fellow was a tech, he came in with a CSCE for general because it hadn't been processed yet. So I added his license for tech, CSCE for general, and he took his extra with those two documents. If you have any documents like the CSCE, also bring that original and the photocopy. If you don't have a FRN number, either because you're new or you have an older license that does not have an FRN number, you'll have to use your social security number. I want to be clear on that because it can cause a lot of grief if we don't have it. Back to that, W2JK.
Okay, yeah. That's a good point. I've not gotten to the license copies yet, but okay. Very good. It's my understanding, though, you do need your FRN even if you have your license, but as you say, sometimes you can see it, sometimes you can't, but original and a copy if you're taking a test. Alrighty, any questions on tomorrow's escapade? Well, you'll be fed all day, it'll be a beautiful thing, and on Saturday there'll be Venture Cruise 7373 Ham Fest and Pancake Breakfast. Vendors can come in at 6 and folks about 7:30 to eat and to go to the Ham Fest. And that's over at Bergenfield at St. John the Evangelist in the William Street in the church hall. And just as an FYI, the scouts are running pasta dinner and square dance with K2ET as the caller in the evening if you're so inclined. We can certainly sell you a ticket for the evening in the morning at a discount, no less. Anyway, enough of that. Alrighty, I think we have some other folks who had some questions. Let's see where we are with those at this point. Let's see. Alright. Our next one is K2 Zulu Charlie. Dave, how was your experience on Echolink?
K2 VAR, this is K2 ZC.
I hear it fine when I have a headset. That's why I signed on this evening and signed off real quick, because I realized my headset's somewhere upstairs and probably in my computer bag, because I've been using it for the ham radio deluxe remote hookup for the radio. So I don't know where my headset is right now. I think it's upstairs somewhere, so I just turned on the 2-meter rig. I haven't done any transmitting on it, so I don't even know if my mic works. Back to you.
Well, there's an icon to hit transmit, and you also can hit the space bar to transmit, and hit the space bar again to receive. It's not a push-to-talk, it's a push-to-talk and push-to-listen. That's how the space bar works. Well, what you might want to do is get yourself a cheapy dollar store headset. You know, the real cheapy ones, they work really well for things like Echo Link and go in your bag and you don't care if you beat it up or break it. You don't have to be anything fancy. So that's something to think about as well. Or just leave it in the shack for use on Echo Link. It's kind of nice. But very good. Anybody have any questions or suggestions to Dave about his setup?
I am using a cheap mic. I'm using a Radio Shack mic. It also has a built-in sound card, so it's plugged directly into the USB port. And it works quite well as far as even for my remote hookup to AM Radio Deluxe. And I did use it maybe a couple of years ago on another computer, so I know it works. I do know how to transmit. I know it's got a space bar just pop up, receive, transmit. I know how to use it, so and I have used it before. I just haven't used it on Nizzer, and I haven't used it recently.
Okay, Doug. All right. Very good. Well, it was good to hear you on there anyway. The other thing for people to consider, by the way, on Echo Link, some of the guys, what they will do is they'll go up on Echo Link and turn the audio down, never transmit, and listen on the radio and talk on the radio. But what they do instead is they use the Echo Link as a chat, as a text chat back and forth. So you can do that too. So you use like a big chat room underneath the net if you so desire. So that may be something to consider as well. Anyway, all right, before we move on to our next questions, do we have any other check-ins? Please call K2BAR. All righty, Tony, I think you might have a comment for the net. In fact, I know you do. What is your comment for the net? And then we'll go to Stuart and Ben. K2AMI, K2BAR.
Good evening, this is K2AMI. I just want to spread around some knowledge that we gained at a kid night a couple weeks ago. Phil Barber, the W8OXC, and I both had trouble with power supplies, and it turned out to be a common sort of problem. And I think they might want to use this as a memory test in the future. If you have a problem with an Astron power supply, they mount a PC board with two screws. The screws go to the top of the very large capacitor, sometimes a 2200 microfarad capacitor. The screws go into the capacitor. The board is between the top of the screws and the capacitor. And the board has got a plated surface on it, copper film surface. And apparently they did this for easy mounting, easy assembly. But it's also a sore spot because it means that the way it's hooked up, the full current of your power supply going to your load travels through that junction of the screw and the plated part of the PC board. And it's not always a good solid contact. So you might want to look into a way to improve that if you do have a problem with it in that area. Larger washers on the screws of one source, also relocating the main feed lines to the actual PC printed board rather than having them go through that through connection would be an option also. Just want to spread that information if you have any problems with Astron power supplies.
I've never seen that one. That's interesting. Anybody else had that experience?
Well, the fact that two of you in the same club had the same experience, suggests that somebody else is likely to as well. So that's good. Think about a third of us have one or more Astron power supplies in our collection of stuff. So that's good to know. Thank you, Tony. Okay. Let's see. Our next question comes from Stuart, KC2SQP. Good, Stuart, K2BAR.
K2BAR, this is KC2SQP. My question is a couple things. Are you going to be down tomorrow night at the Fairlawn Club? The reason is I want to know, I'm going to be away, and I want to use Echolink to contact you guys. I don't know what to do. Somebody's going to have to show me, so tell me what goes on, please. Thank you. Back to net, KC2SQP.
Go ahead, Alex. I'm sorry I'm late with a comment that I wanted to make to the power supply, but I was retained by my YL. You know how it goes, high priority stuff. This system of mounting the screws of the capacitors into the board is common into the AL1500 from MFG. And more often than that, another problem to it is they are using a very cheap printed circuit board with very thin copper on it. So most of the time you have to end up to deposit solder over all the traces that are too thin to get that the current. Especially on the low voltages, like 15 volt power supplies, the Ameritron, not Ameritron, the, the power supply is 15 volts, 20 amperes, 30 amperes, they have the same problem. So a good idea would be to unscrew the screws and deposit a good layer of solder on the top of the traces as far as you can. And turn in your back tonight. Yeah, okie doke. That's another good point, too. Okay. Thank you, Alex, for that little bit of reinforcement. Now, to Stuart's point, by any chance, is anyone going to be available to go down to the to Fairlawn tomorrow and explain this to this whole situation to Stuart on how Echolink should work? I know many of us are going to be involved in the course and the testing and getting ready for the Hamfest the next day, so I don't know who might be available, but I gotta believe if you show up with an installed Echolink, and you've, I'm assuming you've done your administration, you have to go through a whole sort of, authentication procedure to validate yourself on Echolink. Have you done that, Stuart?
K2BAR, this is K2USQP. I have it on my computer. They have me logged in. I have no problems. And I'm going to be down in Texas and New Mexico all next week. And to get to you, what type of node or number do I, if I get on a computer, do I call you so I can get direct to you? That's what I need to know. Back to the net, KG2SQP.
Okay, the first thing you do is before you leave, even tonight, fire up your Echolink. You can even do it right now while we're waiting. And try to connect to K2FoxtrotJuliet-L. K2FoxtrotJuliet-L.
That's K2FoxtrotJuliet. I didn't hear the last part.
Dash or hyphen and the letter L like Lima.
I'm not at my home right now. I'm somewhere else. But that's K2FoxtrotJuliet-L. Okay, what comes next?
Connect to it, and then, as they said, either use the transmit and receive buttons or
keep tapping the space bar. You tap it once to transmit, once to receive.
All right, I'll try it that way before I leave to see how it works. I really appreciate it. I'm back to the net, KC2SQP.
Small comment?
Hey, Alex.
Yeah, if you look into the bottom right corner of the screen, you will see the two icons, transmit and receive, as it taps on the space bar. But you have to set up the computer for space bar, because there are many ways to set up that. But let's assume it is the space bar that is the transmit-receive button. In the right bottom corner, he will see that he transmits or receives. Back to net.
Good point. Anything else, sir?
No. I've written everything down that he said. Back to the net. This is KC2SQP.
Okie doke. Very, very good. And let's see, under the category of last but never least, KF2ID, your question, K2BAR.
Hi, sorry I dropped out for a moment. I was just looking into getting myself a new handheld transceiver. And I was looking into a multi-band one, covering, say, the 220, 146, and the 440 band. And the only thing is, well, not the only thing, number questions, but I noticed that the ASU has one, I believe. It also covers the 6-meter band. Now, is anybody ever use a handheld on 6 meters, that even worth considering? I'm just curious what experience people have ever had with using a handheld transmitter that works on a 6 meter band. That's KF2ID.
Well, I've used 6 meters, both transceive and also receive only. I had a VX 7 that transmit on 6, and I have a THF-6 that will receive on 6, and I've used them both. Frankly, I like having, you know, 220, 440 at full power, but 6 is a lot of fun, too. It's just a little different. You know, I was thinking about, you know, as you mentioned this subject, I was thinking about the fact that you like to hike, and you might want to look at the VX8 Delta, I think it's Delta Romeo, not the Golf Romeo. It's a version of it that has a built-in GPS. It's built into the top of the radio. I think it doesn't do 220. I think it does 2 meters and 440. But the trade-off is it does APRS and has a built-in GPS into the top of the radio, and it will do... APRS text messaging as well as APRS position reporting as you go hiking. So you'll be able to, for instance, have people observe you on your hikes, and you can beacon every 5 or 10 minutes as to where, what your position is. That'd be kind of neat, Mr. Ben, don't you think?
That sounds pretty neat. What was the number of that? What was it, Yaesu? Kenwood, who makes it, and what was the number again?
Yeah, and I'm very loath to recommend Yaesu, but it is a Yaesu, and I'll explain my reservation in a minute. But I just think that it's the Victor X-Ray 8, and it's not the R, or it's either the Delta Romeo or the Golf Romeo. I can't remember which is which. But, I mean, all of them will do APRS. One of them will do Bluetooth, or I can't remember. And one of them will do fewer bands, but has a built-in GPS. It's not a GPS in a speaker mic. It's built into the actual radio. And I think that was a little more clever. And if your vision's good, then you probably can deal with was sending APRS not only position reporting, but also I think texting, short messages via APRS now. That's something to think about. And oh, by the way, the water is, the radio is highly water resistant. I think it can stand either 60 minutes or 30 minutes at 3 feet of water. So, you don't have to worry about whether the radio gets wet. It'll still go.
It's the ZX8GR, the one I see in the QST, Gordon.
Is the GR the one with the built-in GPS, but it only does 2 meters for 40, it doesn't do 220, is that the right? Is that what I'm saying?
That's Roger. It's in the, straight in the pages on the new QST.
Yeah, I did see it, and they had the DR and the GR on the same page, and I think the GR was the one to the right. So you might want to look at that. You have another way of doing it too, and that is getting the GPS microphone. So the GPS is up on the microphone as opposed to the radio, and that allows your radio to sit on your back, you'll see in a day pack, and just bring a speaker mic over your shoulder and clip the GPS essentially onto your shoulder. But I think the display is on the radio, so it really doesn't make much sense. So you can get a lot of benefits from that. But I think it's really cool just to have the tracking ability for your hikes then. And there are all sorts of programs out there that will breadcrumb your beaconing via APRS for a period of time. Not just show your current position, but actually show a trail too. Over.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. I'll have to look into it. It's got room for a visible display. These things are pretty small, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and do consider that. I know my VX7 was not my favorite radio because of the dimness of the display and my vision issues. So I found the Kenwood THF6 a lot better, but it doesn't do APRS. The VX8 is very, very cool. The VX8 GR Golf Romeo is very, very cool. So, maybe it's time to learn a little bit more about it. The other thing I would strongly, strongly, strongly recommend, no matter what you do, is whatever cool software they have to program it and also to help manage the APRS pieces, you might consider investing in as well. I mean, this is not going to be your typical ham radio HD purchase of a few hundred dollars. This is like a big, fat, hairy deal, but you'll have a lot of different, I mean, because you're asking, and I know what you like to do in the way of hobbies, I think this might be an interesting confluence of a lot of your interests.
Okay, now, I'll have to admit my ignorance. I know GPS is you, but what's the APRS?
Amateur packet reporting system, and it will take the GPS readings from your radio, and it'll take your GPS readings and transmit them over your radio on packet through a beaconing system. It'll go through a bunch of gateway digipeters and such, so you'll be able to have lots of people see where you are. And the other thing you can do is you can also type in short messages, let's say, I think up to about 80 characters or so, and they go out over the APRS network, and you can get them back too, so it's kind of neat. So, there's a limited amount of semi-reliable texting that can go on too, especially in places where often there's not good cell coverage. Go figure. So it's something to think about, to say the least.
Okay. I can see immediate limitations. So once you get into hilly areas, you've got to be able to get into a local repeater with not much of an antenna. That, I can see, could be a problem unless you go hiking in the wide open, areas. Frequently I go hiking where and get into the Valley of Hills. And I know some people have trouble getting their GPS unit to work in those areas, but to get into a local repeater for the APS, that might be much of a problem. Is anybody, you know of anybody that could use it that way around here?
Yeah, I do. KO2FB is one that comes to mind. K1VDH, Peter, you know, the president of 1070, and a couple other guys. But Fred Bushner, of course, you know, K2FB, so, you know, they've been known to use APRS quite a bit. I'm going to give you two resources to think about and go look at, and we can have a more expansive discussion on this next week. There's a URL, www.findu, F-I-N-D, the letter U, findu.com. That will show some interesting things. So you can enter KO2FB or K1VDH with various combinations, and you might be able to find some other people as well. But so you also can enter, I think, your zip code, and it'll show everybody within so many miles of your zip code as who's on APRS right now. And that's kind of neat to watch. Sometimes I'll see WB4WZZ, Joe Peters, with it too, if I recall. That's one thing. And the other thing to think about is Google APRS, Alpha Papa Romeo Sierra. And you'll probably get more stuff than you ever... You'll get so much stuff, you'll get a headache. But, there's lots of good stuff out there.
Okay, now what was your problem with Yaesu? I have a Yaesu, car radio. I didn't have too much trouble with it. The only problem I had it was the microprocessor. Every once in a while needed to be reset. First time it happened, it got me thoroughly confused, but once I realized that I had to reset, in the process, of course, losing the memory, which kind of made me a little excited, a little mad, but aside from that, hopefully they would have solved that problem by now. What was your comments on Yaesu?
Okay. Well, here's the book. What I like about Yaesu is they have a very robust handy talkie, very fully featured, but there, the two things that bug me are the dimness of their display, it's just the display, you know, displays on my handy talkies. Now, I haven't looked at the 8, but the 8 does look a little bit better, just as an FYI. But in their effort to save battery power and this, that, and the other thing, they're dim and their fonts are a little funky, but I think the 8 may be a little different, number one. And number two is the, I find programming Yaesu handy talkies to be just abysmal if you have to do it through the front panel. It's just not as easy as a Kenwood, it's not as easy as an Icom, it's not as easy as any number of other radios. I find Kenwood Human Factors to be the easiest, I find Icom Next and Yaesu a distant third. Along with, by the way, I'll give you another one that's another interesting one. The Radio Shack HTX 202, that's another winner from a programming viewpoint. In fact, the Icom 028T had similar issues. They were different, similar but different. Some of the more modern Icom radio and handy talkies are much easier. So I just find it just annoying. There are three things I want to be able to do with a radio, no matter what. I want to establish a receive frequency. I want to establish an offset. And I want to establish whatever I have to do for tone or digital coded squelch or analog squelch. You know, whatever. I want to be able to establish those things quickly and efficiently. And with Yaesu, it just takes, you know. They don't make it as easy as you might think. So that's my only complaint. but they are just robust, fully featured radios that are just, I mean, and again, the VX8, you know, I took one look at it and went, damn, that's nice. Oh, it's an Icon, it's a Yaesu. Oh, well, and for a while I didn't look at it, but then they came out with the GR and the DR, and I might someday.